Today I'm speaking with Matt Goldenberg. Matt is a coach and teacher at procrastinationplaybook.net, where he teaches people how to process their emotions and develop positive and consistent motivation systems. Matt can also be found tweeting profound things at Matt Goldenberg on Twitter. So it's been a few days already since I recorded with Matt, and I've had some time to put the techniques he taught me in the episode into practice. And yeah, I gotta say, they work. So for anyone listening, I encourage you to actually follow along with the exercises if you have the time and the energy to do so. Because I felt like that really helped me see that what he was saying wasn't just the usual self-helpy bullshit, but actually there was something to that. He understands the mechanism in a good way. Yeah, like usual, I don't have my Patreon thing in the middle, so if any of you don't donate to Do Explain but feel like you would like to, go into patreon.com/doexplain. And I've added a new tier called the Dabbler, $1.75 a month. For the person who likes my content but thinks that $4 is, yeah, that's bollocks. To anyone who's already donating, thanks a million. And yeah, I'm just excited to get into the conversation. So here we go. Here is Matt Goldenberg. All right, so I'm here with Matt Goldenberg. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Chris, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I'm a little extra excited today for two reasons. The first one being, as far as I know, I mean, I don't know what the other guests are doing in the privacy of their own homes, but you're the only one I know who uses the blue blocking glasses at night, which I do as well. So I'm curious, is that a nightly thing or is that just on special occasions?
Yeah, that's a nightly thing, and those blue blocking glasses do have also the transcutaneous vagus nerve stimulators attached to them, which are little electrodes that I clip to the inside of my ear to stimulate my vagus nerve, and that's something that I use every night.
Right. And for people who don't know, haven't heard about this, it's not a crazy sex toy or anything like that. It's a yeah, maybe we get into the vagus nerve later, actually, but the blue blocking glasses are meant to block out blue light that disturbs the wake and sleep cycle, or rather, it keeps you awake, keeps the awake hormones going. So I just put them on at 8 o'clock pretty much every night. And even if I have, I'm sitting in my bedroom right now, and if the clock turns 8, even if I'm interviewing, like when I was interviewing David Deutsch, the physicist, I put on the fucking blue glasses on, and I put on another pair of glasses above those because, yeah, I can't see without them. So I look really dumb when I'm doing these interviews at night. So, but it helps me sleep, so I like them.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other reason I'm really excited to talk to you is because a lot of the topics that I touch on this podcast might be a little nerdy. They're very specific and somewhat niched. So for the average listener, it might not be interesting at all. But I feel like the topics we're going to touch today are, yeah, they cater to a much wider audience. And everybody, unless maybe you're a Zen Buddhist monk or something like that in a cave, cares about being more productive, procrastinating less, having good motivational systems. And so, yeah, I'm really excited to have you on.
Yeah, man. I'm pretty excited to see where this conversation goes.
Yeah. All right, so I thought we could start with your personal problem situation, how you ended up here. I don't know if you would respond to the name Productivity Guru, but I've seen it used on Twitter. So yeah, so how did you end up working with productivity? What's your story there?
Yeah, I mean, I want to find that Twitter person who's calling me a productivity guru. So There's a lot of versions of this, right? And I've been into self-improvement for a long, long time, probably 17, 18 years, been really focused on it at this point. Wow. But when I really started to decide to focus on procrastination, let's say, was about 10, 11 years ago. And that was when I dropped out of college. So I had been diagnosed with severe ADHD from a very young age. But basically throughout all of primary school, that's elementary school here in the U.S., middle school, high school, that's everything before university.
Yeah.
I had basically been able to coast on my intelligence, right? Not that I'm a genius or anything, but I was intelligent enough to make it through all of those fairly easily.
Yeah.
And then when I got into college, I was not going to classes. I was not doing my homework without, you know, external structures there. And I ended up dropping out. And that was like a big deal to me, because failing in that way at something was just not something that I was okay with, that I was comfortable with.
Yeah.
Due to my own personal, this is something in me that I wanted to succeed at something and I didn't, right? It was just a big issue to me. And so I spent the next 10, 11 years trying all sorts of stuff related to that, going to different coaches and counselors, reading different books, probably over 100 books on procrastination and nearby subjects, trying different productivity software, journaling systems, everything. And I would have this pattern where I would be productive for a bit and then it would go away, and then I'd be productive for a bit and then it would go away.
Right.
And I never really found something that was consistent until 2.5 years ago, when I started taking a look at everything I had done. And I used some tools to put it together into a system that really understood what's the root cause of my procrastination, and then what are the mental models, movements, and habits I can use to target and overcome that root cause. And so I don't want to lie and say that I never ever have any procrastination issues now. Right. But I can basically get done what I want to get done. I can basically achieve what I want to achieve.
Yeah.
And I can get to the point where, you know, I'm confident that if I chose to go back to school now for whatever reason, I could go to classes and do everything and make that happen. So that's where I'm at now.
Right. And that's basically what matters, right? To be able to do what you feel like you want to do. And but I feel like you're describing the New Year's Eve syndrome pretty exactly there, where people just, they get all this new hope and excitement for the new year, and it feels psychologically great to just get to start from scratch, basically. Which I mean it's just a new day. There's no difference really, but, and then people make all these goals, very lofty goals often. I've been here myself. And then, you know, the gym is the classic example. I'm going to work out 5 times a week or every day. And then you see the first 2 weeks after New Year's, the gyms are just stocked with everyone. And then people just slowly start to fall off after 2 weeks or so. And then, they stop going to the gym altogether. But so would you say that you were you an extreme case when it comes to the procrastinating? Or do you think you were more like the average Joe in that sense?
I would say that I'm extreme in the sense that I had severe ADHD. So for those people who are listening who might have severe ADHD or OCD or something else that would feed into the procrastination, make it really hard, I would say I would the average case for someone like that. And for sort of maybe the average person who doesn't have one of those additional difficulties, and I'm not one to use this sort of diagnosis, you know, I would say that it'd be fair to say I grew up with ADHD and maybe very, very light on the autism spectrum, very sort of low level autism. And I'm not one to sort of use those as excuses, but I do think it's useful to categorize things, say, hey, here's what other people who are like me, how they manage to deal with some of their issues, right? So
So
I would say that I'm more severe than the average case. And I would also say that because of that, I don't consider myself the most productive now. But the reason I consider myself able to teach this is that I was starting from such a hard place. I had to overcome so many issues.
Yeah, yeah.
That where I am now may be more impressive than it seems. And I'm still, you know, above average on focus and productivity at this point.
No, that's really cool. And I find that many people who are really good at whatever it is they do have really had a chip on their shoulder, some personal issues, and they really had to figure it out for themselves. And then, like you said, if you start from a really low point on, or I guess a high point on the procrastination scale, rather, then, yeah, I feel like you're more apt to teach it to people, even people who are not that low. Because you need to know all the ins and outs, probably, to get from that case to where you are now. So that's really cool, man. And, yeah, I wouldn't have pegged you for being on the autistic scale at all, or the spectrum. That's awesome. You seem more social than I am. More sociable. Do you usually frame it in terms of avoiding procrastination rather than becoming more productive? Do you think it's more useful to talk about it that way?
Yeah, you know, I'm still figuring this out. So me teaching the procrastination playbook is, I've only been doing that for like less than 2 years now, year and a half, maybe close to two, coming up on 2 years. And so right now I'm framing it as procrastination. I've been playing around with framing it as having consistent motivation. I typically don't frame it as productivity because I'm not teaching some of the most important things for productivity, like prioritization, at least not in a way that I would say I'm trying to help people to be their most productive. I'm trying to solve that first problem, which is how do you motivate yourself consistently?
But would you say it's fair to say that, yeah, the reason most people are not productive is because they are procrastinating for several reasons we'll get into, I'm sure. And they are naturally productive. If they remove all the hurdles, people are generally naturally productive. Is that something you would subscribe to?
I do not subscribe to that. Even when I'm teaching motivation stuff, I think if you just get rid of your coercive motivation system, is what I call it. The system or the self-loathing monster. That's the thing that causes you to have this up and down motivation, right?
Yeah.
If you get rid of that, there's still the skill of how do you motivate yourself in a consistent way, right? So it's not just like you remove all the blocks and then you're good to go.
Right.
There's still skill. And I think there's further skill. I think the one big thing you're missing is then, okay, even if I can get myself to do all the stuff I wanted to do, is that the stuff that's going to have the biggest impact, right? And that's stuff that I may teach in the future. It's stuff that I'm not so bad at. I'm pretty good at that stuff, but it's not something that I currently teach because I think you need the consistent motivation first.
Yeah, but I feel like those are two separate problems. The first one being, are you productive at all? And then are you productive doing the right or most useful things, right?
I would agree with that.
So I want to frame the conversation a little bit by saying then that I, going into this discussion, still think that that is the case, that if I remove the hurdles for productivity, I start procrastinate. I will be, or people will be, naturally productive. And I'm very, very open to changing my mind on that. But it's just fun to say that that's what I believe going into this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And maybe we could start with, how you view procrastination then. Let's start there. What is procrastination? Like, what's the mechanism there? And then we can look more at, the how of getting rid of it.
Yeah, so there's actually, you know, in the procrastination playbook, we have 8 weeks of material on this. covering the different causes of procrastination from different angles. And so I don't want to simplify it and say there's only one reason for procrastination, right? There's many different things, from overwhelm, where you're not good at knowing where to start, to perfectionism, to indecision. So there's all sorts of reasons, but I think the root thing, the thing that you start with, the thing that's causing people, that sort of is generating most of these issues, is that people have learned from society, from their parents, from looking at how other people motivate themselves, that the way to motivate themselves is through shaming, guilting, forcing, and ignoring. Coercive methods. They feel like they need to make themselves do things. And I can get into why that is not a sustainable motivation strategy. There's a bunch of things that causes that to be an unsustainable way to motivate yourself.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, I want to piece out all the different parts here. But so, okay, so that's the general idea there. That's kind of the common denominator, maybe, in most of these cases, right? But
right,
so,
right.
Yeah, so I like coercion here. I like that word. I'm not sure if you are you into epistemology at all, the critical rationalism and the David Deutsch stuff?
Yeah, you know, I've been going through Popper Book Club.
Oh, cool.
I am very familiar with the rationalists, who are also very deep into epistemology, but they have a very different epistemology than the critical rationalists.
Yeah.
So I'm familiar a little bit with the concept of epistemology, and I'm familiar a little bit with the critical rationalist epistemology.
Right. But it's not a hobby horse for you, as most people who listen to my podcast. Okay. Yeah, because I think you and I might... I think we have similar perspectives on coercion and the issues with it, but I think we're approaching it from different angles. Because I'm coming from the fundamental epistemological issue with coercion, which is, without getting too deep into that, it's authoritarian. And the main tenet, if I had to just choose one for this epistemology, is that there are no final sources or there are no true sources of knowledge in the sense of we can always trust the source to be right. All knowledge, all sources of knowledge are fallible, and all our knowledge is always filled with errors. And what we do when we grow our knowledge is essentially correct errors in faulty theories, but we can never reach any final truth of any kind. So essentially, coercion is a problem because it's hampering the means to error correction. If you coerce me, let's use an external version, if you coerce me to do something, you can never know that you are right. And you're inhibiting me in my own error correction and my own knowledge creation. And so the same thing is true for yourself. If you are just arbitrarily saying that, oh, this idea, maybe explicit ideas, to use the rationalist epistemology, it's they ignore the inexplicit knowledge a lot, as far as I know, and they think that emotions are kind of irrational and it's all about the explicit thinking and logic at that level. And that's authoritarian. You're arbitrarily assigning authority to the explicit content, and thereby you're not allowing for an explicit error correction. And you might be wrong. The explicit ideas might be wrong, and they do make mistakes all the time. They do have errors. And so it's just fundamentally, it's limiting you from creating knowledge. And that includes moral knowledge, which is where you decide what's important to do in your life, how you're going to act. Yeah. And so I know that's not the exact same angle that you're coming from, but I feel like we're still on the same page there. Is there anything I said there that would not go together with your view of coercion? And what is your view?
So there's a few things that I need to bring up. First of all, just because any rationalist listening to this will slap me if I don't mention it. The rationalists do understand the value of inexplicit knowledge, of emotions, of all those things. If you go to something like the Center for Applied Rationality, most of the workshop will be getting you in touch with your emotions, helping you to understand about implicit knowledge, that sort of thing. So I just have to like preface that, because again, I will get slapped if I don't correct that.
No, I appreciate that.
So the other thing, I view coercion from a very pragmatic perspective. I have some Twitter threads out there that are basically puzzling through the question, should everyone practice non-coercion? And the answer I come to is no, right? It's very, very dependent on your goals, on where you are coming from. And the reason that is that we don't have infinite time on this earth, right? If everyone had infinite time and infinite slack in where they were currently at, I would agree with you that non-coercion is in the limit, like a better system, right? But let me give you some examples where it's not a better system.
I love this.
Let's say that you are in a job where you have no savings. You're working basically paycheck to paycheck, and you're forcing yourself to do a job that you hate, right? Now, I do not think that you should be messing around with your motivation system in that way. If you take away your coercive motivation system and you don't, you are for some reason, you have some mental block and you're not able to replace it with a non-coercive motivation system, then you're going to lose your job because you're going to stop working because you're unable to force yourself anymore.
Yeah.
And so in that instance, I think that person should be very careful about messing around with their fundamental motivation system. Here's another example. And here's one that might be more interesting, is that I think that different people have different things they care about in the world. Some people might care about just feeling happy, and some people more care about the external, what they do in the world that brings that happiness, right? The happiness is just a side effect versus the happiness is the end state. I call that the heaven enlightenment dichotomy.
Right.
Now, now if the thing you care about is the end state of the world, right? And you are already really, really productive at making that happen. Let's take somebody like Elon Musk, who probably has more of a fundamentally coercive motivation system, but he's very good at bringing about the world that he wants to with that. I also don't think that, again, if he had infinite time, it would make more sense to go to a non-coercive motivation system, which would probably make him even more motivated in the limit. But he's already so productive with his coercive motivation system that spending the time to do that, to get to a point where he's less productive, to build up the non-coercive motivation system to get back to where he currently is, he would probably waste more time, have less time in his life than he is just focusing on building the world he wants to from his current position, from his current perspective. So I view this from a very pragmatic perspective. What do people want? What are people's situations? And how does changing their fundamental motivation system, how is it going to interact with their life?
Let me ponder that a little bit and poke at it. I think that, first of all, I love the emphasis on we don't have infinite time. Because that's actually something that in the discourse on the epistemological side about non-coercion can often be, forgotten about. And people forget that, in theory, of course, non-coercion is always going to be better. But that doesn't mean, I don't know if you've heard about the fun criterion.
No.
Okay. It's essentially, it ties into this, but it's that what we call fun or flow or whatever you want to call it, play, is essentially when you're non-coercively creating knowledge for yourself. Follow the fun has kind of been a tagline in that community. But then people come up with these questions that relates to what you said. Yeah, but I have this job and I still need to pay my rent. I don't think it's fun, but should I just quit my job? Should I just divorce my spouse because sometimes it's not fun? And no, clearly not. And I think we can talk about piecemeal improvement there. You have what you call the motivational systems that are currently in place. I don't remember what you call them. They instantiate a lot of knowledge still about your wants and your needs. And it would kind of be like if a libertarian says, I don't want the state to have any influence. We should just get rid of the state today altogether. That doesn't work, obviously, but you can still work towards the libertarian ideal while still acknowledging that the government has a lot of instantiated knowledge that we can't just throw away. It seems to me that I'm not sure I agree that Elon Musk has a very coercive motivational structure. I'm not sure if you're making that claim or just using him as a potential example, but I think that he seems like a person who might as well be having a lot of fun doing what he's doing, like following his passion or really enjoying, kind of like Jocko Willink, if you're aware of you know that guy, the Navy SEAL or...
Yeah.
The extreme discipline equals freedom guy. He seems to have a very scheduled and ordered life in a way where I would be miserable. But I think that for him, that's fun. That's a way for him to create knowledge and make progress morally in his life. And I'm not sure if someone's geared towards I want to change the world rather than be happy. What is that? What is that stemming from then? Isn't that another way for them to be experiencing joy or having fun? Or mustn't there be some inspirational inside motivation for that? Or are you meaning that maybe they have, emotionally processing baggage that is driving this kind of behavior? Because what we want is moral knowledge, and we can always be wrong about that. So I don't know if it's... technically right to say that a non-coercive system might actually be better in that sense. But do you see what I mean, or do I make any sense here?
Okay, so there's a bunch to unpack there.
Yeah.
Just give me a second to process some of what you just said.
Yeah, sure, man.
So, first of all, yes, I do think that Elon Musk is using a coercive motivation system, and it's fair to say that. And I do think that a lot of the times he is not having what you would call fun. He is stressed. He is working himself to the bone. I think if you view fun as a state where you feel good internally, right? I think a lot of times Elon Musk is probably not feeling the state most people think of when they say, oh yeah, I'm having fun.
But if you say something like going to the gym, just to take a trivial example, I don't enjoy the physical sensation of burning in my muscles, right? It's mm-hmm. effort. I'm sweating like crazy. I'm suffering in some sense, but it's still fun to me. Because of what the goal of it is, and I'm feeling like I'm enclosing on that, I'm progressing. So it's still what we call the perspiration phase, but it's I would still argue I'm having fun. Couldn't it be the same for him? Or would you say that that's something different?
I mean, I don't know. It's hard. When we get into phenomenology, it's very hard without going through a bunch of exercises to calibrate what each of us mean when we say fun, right?
Right,
So there's a thing that I might call resolve, which is knowing what I want and knowing that I will do what it takes to get that. And if we are calling resolve fun, then I would agree that Elon is having fun, right? Because he knows what he wants and he's resolved to get it.
Right.
But that feels like a very different thing than what most people talk about when they say the word fun.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
And there's the question, right, of what's the internal experience of that? So even in the case where you are doing something that you know some part of you is not going to enjoy, like going to the gym, right? There's two different ways to relate to this. One of them is to ignore, push down, force, or fight against the parts of you that are fighting against this. They say, God, I hate this. And you say, I'm not listening to you. That's weakness. That's badness, right? This is the Jocko Willink school, right?
Yeah, Goggins.
And Goggins, yeah. And this is good. It's useful. Like I said, I don't think everybody should be non-coercive, but it's a fundamentally coercive way to relate to your own desires, parts, whatever. Now, there's another way that you can relate to these parts where you get them on board. They might still not like it. They might still say, like, this is not the need that I want. This is not the thing that I care about.
Mm-hmm.
But they are not objecting. They are on board. Your whole self is dedicated to the task, right?
Yeah.
If you are running, you're not fighting the part of you that says, "Ah, oh, this is painful." That part of you is like, "Okay, this is painful, and I'm okay with that."
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Fundamentally, yeah. Two different ways to do it.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that Elon and Jocko are doing is much more like the first and much less like the second, although it's always on a spectrum, right? There's always a spectrum there.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. I like the nuance in not just advertising that everyone should be non-coercive or trying to non-coercion or whatever. And I do think that, yeah, like you said there, when you clarify what we mean by fun, we can definitely use the more widely adopted version of that word and call it resolve instead, what I'm talking about. And so then I feel like we're essentially on the same page there.
Hmm.
So when you say it's useful, though, or better for some people to use the coercive motivational structures, what are you talking about? Better in the sense of better for them to achieve their goals, or they wouldn't function if you removed them, or
yeah. So it's there's a lot of nuance here. I wouldn't probably use the word better. I would say that if you look at their goals, right, if they're mostly that heaven-oriented idea, mostly wanting to change the world, or there's also sort of actualization-oriented, mostly wanting to become the person that they view as ideal, then in a lot of cases, right, given the limited time, they're going to get closer to that goal, continuing with their current motivation system, than trying to change it to a non-coercive one.
So, let's tie it back to procrastination, because here's where here's one of my hobbies, which is the idea of emotional processing and the ideas of self-love, things that I think many people who are interested in getting things done and taking massive action and 10xing it think is just rubbish, essentially. It's bullshit. Yeah. It's a waste of time. That's not what I need. I need new techniques, new external things to get me going. And I call this the Nike syndrome, the just do it slogan thing, where it's just the external thing. You just have to do it. The problem here is nothing deeper. It's just that you're not doing it, instead of noticing the nuance of, yeah, but if I knew how to just do it, I would do that, man. Something is prohibiting me from doing that. So how do I get there? So how do you view that? What's your view on how emotional baggage and maybe how you grow up and things like that that sound more esoteric can actually have a tangible effect here and be important?
Yeah. So let me be clear. If you are struggling with procrastination, with inconsistent motivation, the number one thing you can do is move to a non-coercive motivation system, because it's fundamentally more sustainable, right? When you're fighting against yourself, you're using energy all the time. And so there is a thing where again, if you're already Elon Musk, you do you.
Yeah.
If you're not Elon Musk and you're trying to become Elon Musk, you'll probably get a lot closer by stepping back, creating a non-coercive motivation system that's fundamentally more sustainable.
Right. And how does that involve emotions? Why do I need to care about my emotions? That sounds ridiculous, Matt.
So let's talk a little bit about this. All right. So
let's get close to the mic for a second.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me spit some wisdom. No. So when you have a coercive motivation system, now, this shows up for different people in different ways. For some people, this is going to be self-loathing, right? This is going to be saying, oh my God, I'm the worst. Why didn't I do that? I need to get to work. For other people, it's going to be more like a drill sergeant. Just do it. Focus on it. Work on it. For other people, it's going to be more like pushing away, ignoring all those negative voices, and just saying, doesn't matter how you feel. Just go forward, right? There's all different ways that this self-loathing monster can show up. But here's what happens, okay? I'm not doing something. I'm procrastinating. I'm not working. And suddenly, my self-loathing kicks in, okay? And again, that shows up differently for different people. I'm just going to talk about how mine shows up. But you can substitute the way yours shows up in this instance. So for me, that's going to be like, oh my God, Matt, why are you not working? You're such an idiot. You're such an asshole. What are you doing? And suddenly, right, there's like a pendulum, right? There's all these negative emotions related to doing the task. There's things like, oh my God, what if I fail? There's emotions like, oh my God, what if I succeed? And then more stuff gets put on me.
Yeah.
There's negative emotions related to, oh my God, it's going to be such hard work. There's negative emotions related to, oh my God, where do I start? So there's all these negative emotions, right? So my system is, all right, if I can just shame myself enough, I can sort of make the pendulum swing. Because I'm going to feel worse about not working than I do about working. Right? So I start shaming myself. You're an idiot. You're stupid. You gotta work. You're gonna be a failure. And if I can pile on that negative emotion enough, then suddenly it outweighs all the negative emotions related to doing my task, and I'm working, right? I'm doing stuff. I'm productive. It's great. I'm feeling good. I'm a good person. And suddenly, what happens? All those negative emotions I built up to get myself to do the task go away. Because I'm working, I can't see myself as an idiot when I'm working. And the pendulum starts to swing again, or the scales begin to tip, and suddenly all those negative emotions related to doing the task kick in again. And now I'm procrastinating again, and now I'm working. So this is one way that you can see that this coercive motivation is fundamentally unsustainable. Because the coercive motivation system only kicks in when you're not working, and as soon as you start working, it goes away again. So there's this sort of seesaw motion.
But okay, so just so I understood it correctly here, so you're saying that you have parts of yourself that have values like, yeah, it's important to work, and I want to do my work, I want to be successful, things like that. And so when you're not working, you're getting all these negative emotions, like you said there. But so when you're actually working, you have other parts that think what? No, I don't want to work. I would rather play video games. Working is stressful. So you have these oscillating opposive forces basically pulling you in either direction. That's what you mean, or
yeah, and you're fighting against yourself, and because of this, fundamentally, it's a tug of war between these two sides of yourself. So you can never have a sustainable a sustainable strategy in tug of war, right? Now, let me talk about another reason why this is fundamentally unsustainable, okay? Because these strategies fundamentally work on making you not like yourself, not listen to yourself, not appreciate yourself, right? You're trying to shame yourself or guilt yourself or force yourself into working. Now, I want you to think, Chris, of somebody that you just don't like. You really loathe them. You don't like being around them. You think they're lazy or stupid or whatever. You have some negative feelings about them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, think about them going through their day, succeeding, being excited for their tasks, getting all their tasks done, having a great day, enjoying themselves, right? Are you excited about that? Do you think they deserve that? Do you think that's something you want for them? Like, in the deepest part of your heart, is that something you really, truly want for them? Right?
I mean, yeah, when you ask me on the spot like this, I want explicitly, yeah, I can realize that it's my issue to not want that. But yeah, I feel a little weird about them succeeding, I guess, yeah.
And even if you understand explicitly, there's part of you that's like, maybe they don't truly deserve that, though, right?
Yeah.
And then now think about somebody that you really love, you care about, you want the best for them, you care about them, you really love what they do. And now imagine them having a great day. Now imagine them, you know, succeeding. Is that something that you feel good about? You want that for them. You want to try and get that for them.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So if you are turning yourself into the first person, the person that you loathe, that's your motivation strategy. That's another cause of this oscillating motivation, right? There's some part of you that's using the fact that you loathe yourself to try to make yourself succeed. But There's another part of you that says, wait, if I am somebody that's loathworthy, if I am somebody that I don't like, if I am somebody that I think is lazy,
I don't think I deserve
yeah. success. I don't want them to succeed.
That's right.
Right? So that's another pattern of oscillating tension.
Mm.
If you are not operating from self-love, then there's part of you that's always going to be sabotaging because you think you don't deserve success. You think you don't want the person who you are to succeed.
Wow. That I really like that. That's very interesting. But so, how does one go about, let's say you're a person, and I feel like I've actually been there, and having said I've been there means that I don't feel like I'm there anymore. I actually don't feel like I have a lot of self-loathing or negative self-talk anymore, which I'm very happy about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've done it through a lot of the things that you're going to recommend later, but maybe I haven't had the explicit method. So I'm very excited to hear your thoughts on that. But let's say you're a person who does this and really resonates with what you're presenting here. Where do you start? What's the important part here? How does seemingly lofty things like, you just got to love yourself, you got to be yourself. Yeah, they don't seem very helpful, but yet there is profound wisdom in that. So what is one to do there?
Yeah, so there's two parts of this, okay?
Right.
So one of our differences of opinion that we might have here is I do not think that if you just take away your blocks that you're sort of naturally motivated, productive in the way. I think you will naturally probably be pretty happy. Right? But I don't think you're naturally be super productive. You need to have a sustainable positive motivation system. That's like one half of the equation. And then the other half is removing these blocks, working through these traumas, working through these internal conflicts, and doing emotional processing.
Yeah.
And so in the procrastination playbook, we start with teaching people the positive motivation system so that when they remove the blocks, they have something to replace it with. They're not just sort of flailing. And they have no motivation because they're feeling good and they don't know how to motivate themselves in a positive direction.
Right, right.
So let's talk about what are the skills? I like to think about this as cognitive strategies, right? So what I did a lot of was taking all of these past 10 years of books and coaching and looking at, okay, what are the actual strategies here? And what's missing from them, right? Do I have beliefs but not strategies? Do I have strategies but I don't know the behaviors? And I went out, I interviewed people and figured out, okay, what are people who love themselves, what are they actually doing internally? So there's a few cognitive strategies we can use here to begin to understand what are the mental steps to allow ourselves to love ourselves, okay? So one of the things that we find when we look at people who love themselves is that when they start out, a trick to use is what's called splitting yourself in two. So a lot of us have issues with expressing love to ourselves. It feels weird. We don't know how to do it. We don't know what to say. But we know what love looks like, both conditional and unconditional love, which I see as two separate but totally valid things. We know what that looks like, right? We know what a parent would say to a child that they love. We know what a lover would say to another lover. We might know what a friend who loves another friend would say. And so what we find when people are starting to learn the skill is that they can imagine themselves in that relationship. Okay, I can imagine myself talking to myself as a child. If I am a parent and I would say, you know, Matt, I'm so proud of you. I am so happy with what you have done. You know, you are a king. Don't let anybody tell you any differently. Whatever it is, right? Different people are going to resonate with different things.
Yeah.
But that process of splitting ourselves into two and imagining we're in that relationship, right? We already have a reference point for that. That feels much easier than expressing it to ourselves. We imagine what a parent would say to a child, and we can express that, right? So that's the first cognitive strategy that we find in people who are transitioning trying to work on self-love is this splitting yourself into two process, imagining you're talking to yourself, and starting with just the words, right? Because the words are where you start from. And then there's a process, a second strategy we can get into in a second. But does that resonate with you at all, that idea of splitting yourself into two?
With an axe. Yeah. No, but no, that's a great idea, I think. And I just want to clarify before we dive deeper that, yeah, so the reason that self-love is important is essentially because not having it is what's causing this oscillating tension. Hating yourself, which is the other extreme, is what's causing you to procrastinate, right? So if someone's still like, oh, but I don't care about self-love. Yeah, but if you want to be productive, you need to get out of the self-loathing phase and actually be on your own side.
Yeah.
That's the most productive
thing
to do.
The first step is to short-circuit your old motivation system. Before you move into the new one, you need to be able to sort of stop the old system, right?
Yeah, right.
And we talked about, right, how if you are loathing yourself, right, that you don't want somebody who you loathe to succeed, whereas you want somebody who you love to succeed.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
So the first step is to get into that love.
That's right, okay. And so I do like that idea, and I think it's a really neat trick to, because like you say, we think love is something that we need some kind of reference point for, right? Something that's not part of us, like you said. So I see how that could be very cognitively useful. But couldn't there be, and yeah, I'm just trying to play devil's advocate throughout this conversation, but couldn't it be an issue with that as well, kind of reifying that, yeah, you have to have an other object than yourself to love in some way where you're splitting it like that? Or
yeah, so there's, so this is a tool to use when you're first learning, and that you're going to go through stages with this. Okay. So first you're just going to have trouble finding the words, right? Trouble just even knowing what to say. And I do recommend that people start with this verbally, unless you have a lot of trouble with verbal thinking, and then you might want to sort of skip that verbal step. Right. And then once you are good at finding the words, what you want to do is be focused on the feeling. What would a parent who is really feeling that love feel for the child? What would a friend who is really feeling that love feel for their, you know, their friend?
Yeah.
Right? So now you've got both the words and the feeling of expression. Now the final thing with the feeling of it, once you have the feeling of expression, is you want to have the feeling of receiving. What would it really feel like as a child to receive that love from my parent?
Mm.
What would it really feel like as a friend to feel that love for my friend, or a lover to feel that love for my lover?
Yeah.
Now, once you have all three of these pieces, right, then you want to focus on feeling them at the same time. And that's when you can switch from imagining you're someone else, right, to imagining yourself as someone else, to imagining to just doing it internally, right? Once you've got those three pieces down, you can combine them and do it to yourself. But doing that all at once can be a lot for people.
Yeah.
And so we start with this process of imagining the splitting yourself into two process.
That's really interesting, man. I really want to get into these in my own life, and really basically I'm just cheating you out of a free consultation here, having you on the podcast. But that's great, man. Okay, so self-love, that's where you start. But then you also said that it was important in the beginning, if I'm not mistaken, to have some cognitive strategies there for build up the positive motivational structure, or the non-coercive one.
Yeah.
So what would that look like then?
So it's very important that when I talk about this strategy, that it's coming from this place of self-love. And I haven't gone through this. There's other self-love strategies we can go to. There's one in particular that, if you're in that self-loathing, how do you transfer over?
But yeah, no, let's do
assume
that.
You've done that, right? Oh, you want to go through that? Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so the second thing here is, when you're in the self-loathing, how do you transfer to the self-love, right? Once you understand what self-love is like and how to express it to yourself, how do you transfer from the self-loathing to the self-love? Because the initial intuition that people have, the initial way that they typically go about this, is they find themselves in self-loathing, right? And they say, no, I'm going to ignore that self-loathing. I'm going to push it away. God, I'm such an idiot for using that self-loathing. What kind of idiot uses the self-loathing I know I'm supposed to be using self-love. God, I'm a failure. I was supposed to be doing this self-loathing. And suddenly you're self-loathing about self-loathing, yeah. Right? So how do you short-circuit that process? Now, the secret is to start by loving that self-loathing. Now, you might imagine a child or a friend, you don't always agree with their actions, right?
No.
But deep down, you know you love who they are as a person, and you might also have unconditional love that you think everybody deserves that love, right? No matter what they do, no matter who they are. And so you can love that person both conditionally for who they are and unconditionally without agreeing with their actions. You might not agree that this self-loathing should talk to you like this, but this self-loathing wants you to succeed. This self-loathing wants you to be productive. It's trying to help you achieve your goals, right? So I can say, oh my God, thank you so much for helping me be productive. I really appreciate who you are, what you're trying to do for me, right? Without agreeing, you don't have to agree with the actions to love someone. So that's step one, is I'm going to love the self-loathing, right? Now, there's a part of me that the self-loathing was loathing. There's a part of me that the self-loathing sees as lazy or incompetent or not doing the task or whatever it is, right? I'm loathing some part of me that I see as bad, right? The part of me is not working.
Yeah.
Now, I don't have to agree with the actions of not doing my tasks, but that part of me also has a positive intention. Remember, there's all those other negative emotions we think about when we do our tasks. There's overwhelm, there's indecision, there's all these negative things that this part of me is trying to prevent me from by not doing my task. And I can love that part of me as well. Thank you so much for trying to protect me. Thank you so much for keeping me from these negative emotions. I might not agree with the actions, but I agree that this part of me deserves love.
And when you say loving them and those sentences there, is that something you do explicitly to yourself in your head, or do you say it out loud? Or
so I think when you're first starting this, it can be helpful if you're in a environment that allows it to do it out loud.
At your job, yeah. Customer service.
If you're in a place that you feel safe and comfortable doing so, it can be helpful to do it out loud. And it can be helpful to say your name or the name, if you want to name the parts that you're speaking to, right?
Yeah.
It can be helpful to do that. Now, otherwise, you can do it in your head. And then, again, eventually this becomes sort of more just a feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
Once you've gone through these steps. But when you're starting, I think the words can help a lot, right? So then, now that you've loved sort of two sides of yourself that were in conflict, right? You love the side of yourself that has this loathing, and you love the side of yourself that was maybe trying to procrastinate, trying to not work. And from that place, you can now bring your love into all of yourself. You can now just have self-love for all parts of you, for all of yourself, right? And then you can act from that place to get into this positive motivation system, which we can get into in a second.
I think that's really cool. And I just have a few clarifying comments there as well and questions. So, yeah, I think, first of all, we have to distinguish this from some people might hear that and say, oh, it just sounds like you're telling me to do positive affirmations, right? And I don't think that's the case at all. And I'd like to hear your view on that. But to me, just thinking on the fly here, positive affirmations seems to be the same problem, just ignoring the parts of you saying that, yeah, you suck, you're worthless, and then just trying to taper over them with these meaningless statements, essentially, because you don't believe them, and you're trying to just forcefully force yourself to like yourself. Whereas I think the important thing you're saying here, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that every part of you, even the parts that are causing you suffering here, they have, like you said, they have a positive intention. They are there for a reason to help you solve overwhelming problems for you. And they are not the best solutions to these problems, but they are the best ones you had, and they served a protective function. And I think that's something that people miss a lot in this instance. And I think that it really helps to just get that insight click into place, right? Because then without that, it's really hard. Then it just becomes positive affirmations, right? If you don't understand that it's actually a helpful thing and it's trying to do something for you. And just to give a quick example in the way I think about it, let's say that, I mean, when you're a kid, you don't have that much knowledge about the world yet. You're creating all these theories and ideas for yourself in your own problem situation. And then let's say just an easy example that your dad scorned you when you were watching TV instead of doing some task that he thought you were supposed to do, right? And that felt extremely painful to you. You felt like he didn't love you. You felt fear of abandon, maybe even. Because when you're a kid, things are really overstated. You don't know that your dad saying that to you in that tone, maybe having a bad day, doesn't mean that you're not love-worthy or that he's going to leave you or whatever. But so you internalize a model of your dad, essentially. You create this voice in your head that is going to predict the situations where you would get this scorn from your dad externally. And then you scorn yourself internally because that's less painful and less damaging to you, right? But would that be close to how you view it? Yep.
Yeah. So I think there's an important thing here. I think there's lots of different models of emotions, right? Some people think, well, it's all based on evolutionary stuff, right? Like, it was dangerous to be in a group of people who I don't know, so I'm scared of them in a group of people who I don't know.
Yeah.
Now there's an alternative view that emotions are coherent. And what that means is that emotions are based on sort of internal, subconsciously held beliefs about the world, right? And I don't think that either of these is a fully complete view, but I think you can get really, really far with the emotional coherence view. And I think it probably explains for most people something about like 80 to 90% of their emotional reactions are explained to the emotional coherent view. And maybe we'll be able to demonstrate this if later we want to get into some emotional processing stuff and maybe show some stuff off. Maybe we can sort of demonstrate how this happens and what it looks like in an individual.
Oh yeah. I'll happily be your guinea pig today, man.
Yeah. But I think that's a really good point. And, you know, I have a YouTube video about affirmations. And I say affirmations are sort of like if your TV is not working, and so you start like smacking the side of it to get it to work, right? Like occasionally that's gonna work. Occasionally that's gonna help. But a lot of times that's just gonna make things worse.
Yeah.
Whereas if you understand what's going on under the TV, right, and you like open it up, you see what's happening, you see the wire that's broken, and you reconnect it, that's very different, right? So if we understand the deep reasons for our self-loathing, for our the reasons that the task is wrong, we give them love, so we're not coming from a place of pushing them away, we're coming from a place of understanding them, that then allows us to come to a place where we can work through them, right? Rather than just trying to hit the TV and hope that it works. Let's talk a little bit about these positive motivation systems, right? So maybe we can do a little exercise here. I think this concept is best experienced, because otherwise you sort of just have to take my word for it that this works. And so if listeners are listening, they can sort of follow along with this process, okay? So do you have maybe a smaller task that you've been putting off, Chris, something that you could, you know, maybe make progress on in, you know, 3 to 5 minutes, but it's a smaller task that maybe you haven't been working on, you haven't been doing?
Yeah, I can think of one.
So when you think of that task, right, I just want you to notice your feelings, what comes up for you. Are there any sort of negative emotions related to it?
Yeah, I feel maybe a slight tinge of anxiousness, yeah.
Okay. So, we're just gonna, there's different emotions, there's different ways to deal with them, but you can always start with this just self-love part of it, right? Just noticing, hey, why am I anxious about this? Maybe I don't know where to start, maybe I'm scared. And just loving that part of you, using that, splitting yourself into a new process, and take a moment to just love the anxiety, love the anxiousness. and allow yourself to express that love for either just because everything deserves love unconditionally, or because there's a positive intention here, and you want to love conditionally, you want to love that positive intention. Just take a moment to express that love, because that's where we need to start from, is short-circuiting that coercive motivation system with self-love. And let me know when you sort of feel that you've done that, that you're there, that you're loving yourself as much as you can in this moment.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I got it.
Okay. So now, right, there's a problem. A lot of people now don't know how to motivate themselves because you don't have that self-loathing thing anymore. So I'm going to show you one strategy that you can use. And it's based on this idea of creative tension, right? And it's so important that you don't do this until you're in self-love, because if you do this in self-loathing, this is going to amplify your self-loathing. But I just want you to think of the end state of this project being done, okay? Imagine that you're to the end state. And when I say the end state, I don't mean like you're doing the last action. I mean, you're imagining when there's no actions left to do.
Like just this small task, or what I want it to lead to, and like,
whichever feels better to you in this moment.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So imagine that end state. We call this the vivid outcome. Now, if it's a task where you don't know what the end state is going to look like, then you can imagine how you will feel when you have completed the task. But if you can imagine the vivid, like what it would look like when the task is done, I want you to do that. Okay. So let me know when you're imagining the end state.
Yeah.
Okay, now while holding that image of the end state and how that would feel, I now want you to bring up the current state, the state of the project as it is now, and how that feels. So you're holding these two things at the same time. Now, if you or anybody in that is listening has trouble holding these at the same time, then an alternative method is you can start switching slowly between these two things, okay? So either you're holding these two images, the end state and the current state of the project at the same time, or if you have trouble holding two things at the same time, I want you to just slowly switch from one to the other, okay? So you're holding them at the same time. And what this is doing is creating what's called creative tension. It's juxtaposing what is with what could be. Let me know when you're doing that.
Yeah.
Okay. Now we want to really amp up this tension. So what we're going to do is I want you to sort of physically overlay the two images. So you have the image of what is, and then you can imagine the ghostly image of what could be sort of physically overlaid on top of that in your visual display. If you're feeling two things, I want you to imagine what you could be feeling in the future is sort of a ghostly feeling on top of in the same place as how you're feeling now with the project as it is now.
So does it matter in what order, like if you put the positive on the negative or the other way around? Or
it's not positive and negative here. It's current and future. Yeah, and yeah. The future, the thing that is not yet, you want that to be the sort of more transparent one, because that is sort of the thing you don't have yet.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I got it.
Okay. Now notice how you're feeling right now. This is creative tension, right? And again, it's now, if you were doing this from a place of self-loathing, you might be like, oh my God, there's so far to go. I haven't done anything. Why have I not worked? But coming from a place of self-love, you have what you have now, and you have something that would feel better. You have something that would be better. Coming from a place of self-love, you want the person you love to have the better state. Are you noticing some resolve in you, some motivation to work on this task?
Yeah.
Right? And notice, at no point cool. did we go into self-loathing. At no point did we say, this person is awful. At no point did we have to force ourselves. We just said, here's where we are now. Here's where we could be in the future. It's not like I hate where I am now. It's just, here's a person that I love, and I want them to be in the best state possible. Right?
Mm.
So that is called motivational contrasting. And that's sort of the first thing that I teach people in terms of their motivation system. Now, there's other stuff. We talked about play earlier. There's stuff like, okay, how do I get play into this? There's all sorts of stuff that you can bring in, but that's sort of the very basics of beginning to learn a positive motivation system, is using that motivational contrasting tool to develop this creative tension feeling.
Which will then repel you, hopefully, to actually do the task without feeling grossed.
Right. Yeah. So when I do this in workshops, I then have people actually work on the task for a few minutes and just notice how it feels to work on it without coercing themselves, just feeling this resolve that doesn't come from coercion, right? And I think if anybody's listening and just went through that, I'd recommend pausing the recording and going to actually work on the task that you were going through with this feeling. Just notice how that feels. Work on it for a few minutes just so that you have now, phenomenologically, you know what that feels like to work on a task from a completely non-coercive place.
First, on the practical level, what you said there last, I would assume it might be common until you're actually familiar with it and you're used to the process to maybe oscillate in and out a little bit. So you start doing the task, you have the feeling, and then you might get some of the self-loathing again, and you have to go back to kind of find the self-love and then do this process again. Or
yeah, so once you have the resolve, oftentimes the resolve will stay there, right? So you can just hold the resolve, and then you might get into the self-loathing and just the self-love, and then you might not have to go back through motivational contrasting because it might already be there.
So, okay, so once you've actually established that juxtaposition, it's just there. You have that insight, sort of.
Oftentimes. If the resolve drops, feel free to use this again.
Yeah.
Now, there's a few things that can come up here that block this, right? So one of the things is if you imagine the end state and there's something you do not like about the end state, this is not going to work. You need to have what we call unqualified desire for the end state, right? And we don't really have time to cover if you have like all the different types of resistance that could come up to the end state, or to working on the state that could prevent that feeling good about the end state. But like, that's something that could come up. So this is really only going to work for those tasks where the end state you want unambiguously, right? Yeah. And you were asking about like, hey, should I focus on the bigger task or the smaller task? That's one thing that could come up. You might be focusing on this big task. You feel great about completing it, but it's so overwhelming. Mm-hmm. In which case, you might have to choose a smaller task that you focus on the end state of. To deal with that. There's a bunch of stuff that can come up in this vein, but this is the basics of a non-coercive motivation system.
Yeah, I mean, we still want people to buy your courses and stuff, so we shouldn't exhaust it too much.
Yeah, I mean, if it's good for them, right? And I'm happy to give away as much as I can here, and if you like this, you know, feel free to, if you want more, feel free to reach out.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think that I was positively surprised here when we tried it. I always feel like having tried, just like you said in the beginning, that you had done that, having tried a lot of self-help products and techniques and not really, kind of felt like you've tried to dress a turd in a suit rather than actually dealing with something and making some progress there. It was really cool. I enjoyed, first of all, the separating myself into two pieces like that and then relating it to how I feel love for my wife. And when she's feeling scared, like she had a moment this morning when she was nervous and scared about something in her Swedish class. She was having a presentation or something. And just the way I feel about wanting her to feel better and wanting to help her and comfort her, it was kind of cool too. Yeah, to get, when I made that separation that you said, then it was much easier to compare it to that and then manifest the same feeling for myself. That was really cool. And then, and this motivational thing actually felt really good as well. But so what I'm curious about is, because my first thought is from the external, it looks kind of like I used to listen to Tony Robbins a lot. And he talked about how, kind of reward and punishment, the standard idea that that's the way to motivate people. Now, I don't subscribe to that model at all. I don't think it's...
I agree.
I think you agree. But so this is not the same because... You're not trying to run away from pain or run towards pleasure. It's more like you said, you're coming from a place of self-love and wishing yourself into that better place from an already okay place, I guess, of being accepting and loving.
Yeah.
So it's not like Tony Robbins used to say, imagine yourself when you're 80 years old and you're sitting in this rocking chair, right? And you're thinking back on your life and you're thinking back about not doing this task that you're procrastinating on right now, mm-hmm. how would you feel? How would you hate yourself? How would you loathe yourself? So it's a very different thing that on the surface might look kind of similar externally, but it's completely different internally, right?
Yeah, and I think this is why I teach through exercises, because you can't. It's very hard to, maybe you could do it, but I can't give the philosophical justification for why it's different, right? Why exactly it's different. But when we go through the steps, we go through the mental processes that somebody who motivates themselves in this way goes through, then we can feel how it's different phenomenologically.
Yeah, I mean, let me give it a try, justifying it philosophically. And my audience hate that word, justifying it.
Sure.
I think it's the difference between external and internal motivation, basically. Like you have, this might be way too simple, so please address it if that's the case. But I think that there's a way to come from, I don't know who said this, but like you can be motivated from desperation or from inspiration or something like that. And one is coming from lack. And I need this. I need to get to this end state because it's not good enough as it is now. And I constantly have to have this chip on my shoulder to motivate myself. And I also think that's why many people might be afraid to actually start with this self-love and things like that, because they think they're going to become, you know, lazy zombies. I'm just laying here loving myself. I'm not going to do anything. And I think that's a mistake. And this is might be where we differ a little bit on the whole naturally productive or not. I think that, there's a place where you're coming from abundance in the sense that you are already okay the way you are and everything is good enough as it is in that sense. There's nothing you have to do to become complete as a person. And from that, being a human mind, you're still going to have interest. You're going to be inspired and drawn towards different things because that's a natural state of our minds. We want to create knowledge. We want to make progress. We want to understand and explain the world and our lives. And so I think that that's a big misconception, that you need to come from desperation, lack of something, rather than feeling whole as it is and then just being inspired to do stuff because they're fun, they're interesting. You don't just want to sit on your ass all day.
Yeah. So my thought on this is that the people who say it's just natural, these are the people who I went and I modeled these sorts of cognitive strategies from, right? I did interviews and I said, okay, what's going on in your mind now? And we find that a lot of people do things very similar to this motivational contrasting thing. But that's not it's not the thing that everybody's brain naturally does. Some people stumble across it. Some people, right, if they get rid of their coercive motivation system, they don't have this. They don't have this tool to motivate themselves with inspiration. They don't know how to do these things like contrasting and show themselves that it's a better state. And so when you say it's natural, I think it's natural for some people because they stumble across these strategies. And for other people, if they just get rid of their motivation system without learning these strategies, they're going to be a little stuck. And I've definitely had people come through my courses where they ran into some issue and they got rid of their old motivation system. And then the new system wasn't quite quick clicking. Right, so I had to spend a little bit of time with them hooking up their new motivation system to their old actions, and they were sort of stuck before that. So I've definitely witnessed that happen.
I've experienced that relatively recently myself, where I've just noticed and kind of deconstructed how much of my motivational systems have actually been coercive rather than coming from inspiration, and it can leave you very empty or feeling very hollow, like, okay, I don't feel inclined to do these things anymore because it wasn't for the right reasons, as it were. But like you say, I'm not really sure what I do want to do with my life instead. I've always had this set purpose. I need to work out and become really buff because I'm so skinny and I'm not good enough to be loved by my dad, is what I've come to the conclusion. Like it felt very conditional, his love. And so I've just gone through several different things with similar structure. And now I've just stopped feeling like I need to do those. And then what the fuck do I want to do? So I've just spent days in bed just actually thinking through what I like, re-experiencing what you're supposed to learn when you're a kid or whatever, when you're finding yourself, quote unquote. I'm redoing it now as almost a 30-year-old, and it can be really scary. And I've been lucky, I guess, in that I've had the tools to be able to do that on my own and come out the other way.
But, not just the tools, but the slack to be able to do that as well,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So then I completely understand what you mean by just taking that away and not having certain parameters in place to be able to create something better. That isn't better. That is just kind of nihilistic almost. But I don't think we disagree that much then. But don't you think that, because that's just a matter of not knowing what you want to do yet. Don't you think that...
It's not just that. That's a big portion, right?
Okay.
And that's something we spend a lot of time in the procrastination playbook. At a certain point is we go through, we teach you how to elicit your deepest values,
mm-hmm.
and then how to turn that into a vision that motivates you. But it's not just that. It's not just knowing what you want. It's also knowing how to motivate yourself towards what you want without coercion, which is the exercise we just covered, right? Even if you have a powerful vision that's really exciting to you, desire is different from resolve, phenomenologically. Just having to wanting, knowing what you want, is different from having the resolve to do that. And you need to do something akin, related to that motivational contrasting exercise we just went through, to, without coercion, take yourself from that desire, that wanting, knowing what you want, to resolve, knowing what you will do. So I do think, having gone through this with a bunch of people, that there is both knowing what you want and then knowing how to motivate yourself non-coercively towards what you want.
Right, but isn't that just, because I guess what I'm thinking here is, my sticking point is that the way I view minds are as these generative creative programs. They are essentially, knowledge creating programs. So they consist of these, to borrow from David Deutsch, this slew of inconsistent ideas. Thinking is basically walking around in this slew trying to make the worst inconsistencies consistent. And as soon as you solve one inconsistency, a new unforeseen one will pop up. And that's just how it works all the time. So that's where the fun criterion comes in, that the function of the mind is to create this knowledge. And when you're doing that, you're feeling good. You're feeling you're in the flow. You're having fun. You're playing, whatever you want to call it. You're happy.
Right.
And so to me, when you say that, a person can be just happy, can be get rid of the self-loathing part and just be happy, but not do anything or not be creative. I that is a conflict to me that I can't resolve. I don't know if it's just a linguistic thing.
Yeah, so I wouldn't put it like that. What I would say is that when you are even coming from non-coercion, there are lots of ways to satisfy your curiosity.
Yeah.
And if all you care about is feeling happy, is satisfying your curiosity, you will often take the path of least resistance to do that. So the worry that people have, aren't I just going to play video games all day?
Yeah.
I think that is actually a valid worry if you don't have this positive motivation system, because video games, you're constantly discovering new things. You're constantly having fun, right? You're constantly solving challenges, all of these things that our brains want to do, right? That our brains naturally want to do, they end up doing. Now, you're still going to have conflict because if some part of you is heaven-oriented, cares about other things, and or if you need to, if you're not independently wealthy or and you need to work, right? The part of you that are worried about your safety knows you can't do this forever is going to be conflicting. But just because you have that conflict, right, and you want to solve that, you want to solve that conflict, doesn't mean, even when you're not coercing yourself, doesn't mean that this desire to have fun and discover things in the video game isn't going to be stronger. One of the functions that a non-coercive motivation system covers is how to create resolve for longer term things, over the long term, how to communicate essentially between your past, present, and future self and get them all on board with where you want to be going. I think oftentimes if you just take away the non-coercive motivation system, it's going to, you can end up, especially with someone like me, if you have executive function issues or ADHD, you can end up sort of prioritizing your present self,
mm-hmm.
Just because of the sort of inherent, we'll call them biases. I don't know if I quite like that word, but the inherent biases of the human brain.
Yeah, I would actually dispute biases as a concept altogether, actually. But that's a different conversation. But I do think that what you're saying, what you're calling having the non-coercive motivational systems in place might just be what I would call, yeah, having created the right moral knowledge to be able to prioritize between your values and realizing that in the long run, the morally right thing for you to do would be to maybe play video games an hour or 2 hours a day instead of 14 hours a day and actually go to work and love your spouse and do the dishes and things like that. So, yeah, I think that we are actually on the same page there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And so for me, it's really important. It's not just knowledge. It's phenomenological skill, which you could say you have the knowledge of the phenomenological skill.
Yeah, I would call it. Yeah,
but
exactly. Yeah,
I think it's really important to for people to understand that it's very easy to blame yourself, right? It's very easy to get back into coercive thing when you're like, well, I have the moral knowledge that this is better, and yet I'm still here playing video games, right? And just knowing that, hey, there's a skill of how to connect with that knowledge in a way that creates resolve rather than just desire. It's just a skill. It's something that you can learn, and don't think that, oh, I'm a bad person because I have this knowledge, this more quote unquote more knowledge of what to do, and I'm not doing it. Try to teach yourself these skills, and you can sort of bridge that gap.
Yeah, and just to clarify, I'm using knowledge in a much wider sense than just explicitly knowing that. I would call having that skill a type of inexplicit knowledge.
Yeah, I would agree with that as well. Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. I liked it. I really like the whole vibe I'm getting from you here and this whole perspective. It's because it's cool how you've connected the seemingly hippy-dippy, love-yourself phenomenological thing to actual real-world practical results. I haven't seen that. I haven't come across that before. And I think it's very unique. And I'm happy that we got to go into some practical things here so that people can actually put it into practice and start working on that.
Yep.
But I was going to, since this is my podcast after all, I'm selfishly going to go into some more nerdy theory stuff with you because that's what I love to do. And so I'm curious because I do a lot of emotional processing myself and there are very many different frameworks and modalities to do this. And I've done a little research on you on Twitter leading up to this, and if I'm not mistaken, you're kind of you have a very delicate detailed and intricate protocol for where to do different things at different stages and what method works best. And if I'm not mistaken, the central underlying explanation or theory about what you're actually doing is the memory reconsolidation theory, right? Would that be accurate?
Correct.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
So yeah, I don't know. Could you maybe outline that model? What is it that's actually going on in any successful therapy modality when we're processing emotions? Like, what is that explanation? And then we can go into some different modalities, maybe.
Yeah. So I think there's actually a few things going on, but I think memory reconsolidation is sort of the main thing. So to give people just a bit of history, a little bit of context. So for a long time, the theory of the mind was that we had, and I'm going to be simplifying here, and I'm also, this is, you know, I'm an amateur here, so just forgive me if I make any mistakes.
You're forgiven,
but
unconditionally.
But, thank you. The theory was that we had short-term memory, right, where we can remember things that we just learned, and then eventually that gets if certain conditions are met, that gets encoded into long-term memory, and there are different things that can get encoded. We can encode facts, we can encode memories, and we can also encode emotions, right? And so we could encode this idea that, you know, I remember that I was scared when this thing happened with my parents. And that gets tied in with the fact that therefore, like, you know, authority figures are scary. Right. And all of those sort of get tied in together. And then next time I am with an authority figure, I feel a little anxiety. Right. And that's my long term memory. And basically, when something is encoded into long term memory, the theory was that it's basically encoded there forever. And so the only way to, if I want to no longer feel anxiety around authority figures, the only way to do that is I need to create some other association that's stronger, right? Neurons that fire together wire together.
Yeah.
And so I need to make some other neuron fire more likely to fire than the other one. So this is where we get cognitive behavioral therapy. Every time I say I am in a situation with an authority figure, I'm gonna feel the anxiety, and then I'm gonna say, no, it's okay. I'm gonna notice all the facts, I'm gonna notice things, and I'm gonna challenge that. And eventually I can have this relaxation response if I practice it more than the other one, right? But the other one is still there, and so there's still problems with what we call extinction or relapse, where suddenly something can happen and the old thing starts firing again, mm-hmm. right? And so for the past, you know, whatever, 50 years since CBT has been the gold standard, this has been sort of how we've been when treating therapy. It's a very slow process. It typically takes about 2 years to fully get to subconsciously switching yeah. from one response to another.
And it's mechanical. Response.
Yeah. Now, more recently, we've discovered, at least in rats, this process called reconsolidation. Now, what we found, what they think they found, and again, this is very new. Again, it's maybe 30, 40 years old. And so it's still, we're still working on exactly what's happening here, but I'm going to just go forward and
yeah, be bold,
forward and
my
pretend
friend.
As if the science is a bit more settled than it actually
yeah.
is. The idea is that rather than something going into long-term memory, it gets into what's called the labile state, and then it gets encoded into long-term memory. There is a process by which long-term memories can re-enter the labile state, change, and then go back in. And again, when I'm saying memory here, when I talk about memory reconsolidation, I'm not just talking about memories themselves. We're talking about the memories, we're talking about the emotions attached, and we're talking about the facts or beliefs related to that, right? So the they found this in rats that if you create a stimulus response pair where you can shock them when a certain thing happens, and then they would you know, when a certain sound went, and then they would associate the sound with the shock. But if you're able to bring up that emotional feeling of fear, and while that was activated, while that sense of fear was activated, if you could then challenge that while it was activated, you could challenge that and give them a new response, give them a new way to feel while keeping that fear activated, then you could actually return this memory to labile state, and then whatever their new feeling was, that would get re-encoded. So rather than there is some set of neurons, and then I'm trying to create some other set of neurons that's stronger than the other ones, I can actually take the same set of neurons and change what was encoded in those neurons to a different feeling. And this can happen in 15 minutes. Rather than taking 2 years to do this change, you can do this very, very quickly. So when we talk about electroconvulsive therapy, which I know a lot of people have negative associations with, but it's actually very, very effective therapy for treating anxiety and depression, and specifically PTSD, right? Mm. When you have these very strong emotional reactions to something that you shouldn't be having an emotional reaction to, like a loud noise, because suddenly you're back on a battlefield when that happens, you find that electroconvulsive therapy can actually get rid of these reactions. And what's happening is you ask people to remember these traumatic experiences, and the electroconvulsive therapy is actually like just like turning on that labile state with electricity, and then it gets reconsolidated, right? So it's a little bit different, but that's like the basics of what's happening.
Yeah.
So that's the theory, I think, when we talk about these transformational modalities, like focusing, biomotive, a whole bunch of different ones. That's what's happening, is that they are finding a way to activate the old memory and keep it activated while challenging it. The difference with CBT is that you're sort of pushing away the memory rather than activating it. You're trying to challenge it rather than activating it with curiosity, exploring it, and that's what you need to make the reconsolidation happen. It needs to be activated. You need to be exploring it rather than pushing it away and shutting it down.
Right. So the CBT modality goes straight to the challenging without having the activation and maybe the juxtaposition of the old state and the new state as a falsifying comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No. I actually think that one has to be very careful when drawing analogies from the animal studies to humans. I think that in this sense, where we do have programs running on our brains that we share with the animals, I do think that it adds an extra layer when we're talking about humans. I don't think that we can talk about it purely in a conditioning like sort of way where we could with the rats. But I do think that this is a very useful framework. And I think it has something really right there. And I guess what's... I had a good question here, I thought. I just completely blanked it. I think after a long day, my memory isn't working that well.
No problem.
Just give me a second here. Yeah, so I looked at some of this research. And I saw that... I think it was a recent study... because this theory is originating from the book Unlocking the Emotional Brain, right? I think.
Yeah, there's a few people who sort of converged on it at the same time. Okay. And that was one group with the coherence therapy people.
And then there was some cognitive science journal that published an article where they changed the model somewhat, but the underlying thesis was basically the same. And the idea was that, because it's an interesting problem, why do different type of therapy seem to work and for different people at different times, and even though they seem so different, it's said that these emotional schemas, we can call them, you call them memories, but I think they call them schemas, right?
Patterns, I think schema is a better word for it.
Right. Yeah, because it can be more inclusive than just when people hear memories, it might just be, you know, a visual thing, or it can contain more than that. But so, these emotional schemas, there are different ways of attack to activate them. And I think your model, correct me if I'm wrong, but your model based on this cognitive science journal model was you have the felt sense, I think, the somatic entry point. So by feeling in your body certain sensations or using your phenomenology, you can activate different schemas. Then you had the, now I don't remember what your words were, but they had the semantic one, right? The, what would you call that one?
Yeah, which you would typically call beliefs.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's, so beliefs would be like the, what people would know it as.
Yeah, so like, I think I'm a worthless person that doesn't deserve to be loved or something like that. So you can actually, there are modalities where you can actually say that out loud, like the bioemotive framework that you mentioned. Utilizes this sometimes where you can just say, try out different sentences like that. I feel worthless. And then you feel for any change, and you can do that many times and try different words. Focusing as well. Try to connect an explicit handle to a felt sense. And then you had you also had the episodic, right? The memory.
Yeah, memories.
You call it memories, yeah? That's straightforward. That makes sense. And you had a fourth one.
Metaphors would be the last one.
Right. And that's something I had strong experience fairly recently, a few months back, where I strongly felt like I had worn an armor my entire adolescent life, and now the armor was gone, and I felt very vulnerable in a nice way. But that's another way to activate it, through using metaphor. And we can spend an entire 5 hours talking about these different versions, I imagine. But is there anything you can say about yeah, using this kind of explanatory model in practice to build on what we did before. Like, is there any recommendations you can make, or just talking about it in theory is fine too. I think that's fun too.
I don't. Can you rephrase the question?
Yeah, I'm not sure myself what I asked there. Yeah, so. Okay, so how do you use this theory in practice? Like, what's a way to build on what you taught us before, but maybe include some of these things to continue that work?
Again, this is one of those things where we can talk about the theory, but it's very hard to get it without trying it, getting the phenomenology. So I'll give you like a few basic rules. And we can. I'm happy to just talk about the theory, and I'm also happy to sort of give people a little demonstration of what this might look like in practice, which might help to ground it a bit.
Yeah, definitely.
So, like, one of the key things to recognize is that there's like two really important things to recognize here, right? What we talked about, the coherence idea, like emotions have purpose, mm-hmm. right? They're not just sort of randomly firing. They're grounded in these metaphors, beliefs, memories, and bodily sensations.
They have their own logic.
Logic to them, exactly. Now, there's a sort of trade-off when you talk about memory consolidation, where, again, if you're challenging something too much, it's going to deactivate the schema. And once the schema is deactivated, you can't have reconsolidation. Mm. However, if you don't challenge at all, that's the second thing you need for reconsolidation. You need to both activate and challenge it. So, The model I use is just starting from modalities that are very light on challenging and very heavy on just experiencing, activating, feeling, and then we gradually introduce more and more challenge over time once we've done a lot of this acceptance and feeling, and that's where the reconsolidation can happen. So that's like one of the things I think about a lot, is sort of gradually moving up. Now, the final thing that I like to think about is this idea of internal conflict. So typically, if you're feeling an emotion that you don't want to feel, there's one side of you that thinks the emotion matters for some reason, and there's another side of you that doesn't want to feel the emotion, right? There's some conflict where some part of you wants one thing, some part of you wants another thing. I think people can get sort of laser focused. They know what is right. They know where they want to end up. And they want to get rid of the emotion, right? Whereas I think that's quite likely to not lead to reconsolidation. And if it does lead to reconsolidation, it'll be an unskillful reconsolidation. I tend to want to bring in both sides, right? Does it even make sense to get rid of this emotion? Does it even make sense to do this thing that I've been wanting myself to do? What are the deep underlying emotional reasons that I care about, like you were saying earlier, going to the gym, right? And it's really important to do both sides. And in fact, I always start with questioning the side that I am more sure about, because that's where there's more room for growth, right? If I already think this emotion is bad and then I try to challenge it with the fact that it's bad, not much room for growth. If I think something is good and I start challenging and questioning that, then I end up with a more nuanced, more wise approach at the end when I get this new third perspective in reconsolidation. So those are like three sort of theories, things you might want to think about when working on reconsolidation.
Okay, so two questions. Do you have any experience with, I assume you do, and do you ever recommend, or maybe more reasonable, what are your thoughts on somatic therapies that include working physically with how different memories and emotional memories are stored in the nervous system and tension in the body? I'm thinking TRE, for instance, trauma release exercise. That's a big favorite of mine.
Yeah.
And then also a somatic thing. What's your view on crying as a therapeutic modality? And I'm using crying or even sobbing, not in the self-wallowing, pitying way of just feeling sorry for yourself over and over and nothing good really comes out of it, but crying as an explicit problem solving. Because those two modalities that I mentioned there are the most transformative in my life. And I do feel like there's something too. I think bioemotive framework has something similar where, yeah, you kind of build up this well of unexpressed emotion, often sadness, anger, things like that. And I feel like that's actually the case. Things that have been extremely physical. My whole life I worked on certain injuries and stretching and massaging, physical therapy. Nothing much has happened. And then I've had kind of what I would put in this framework that you mentioned to us here, activating an old schema, reconsolidating it. And all of a sudden I have 5 inches more movement in my shoulder joint.
Yeah.
Right, there and then. Mm-hmm. And I used to think that was silly, and now I think it's so tangible and really something to that. So what do you think of about that?
I'm still, so in terms of what we would call like a Gio's lever model of what's happening with muscle tension and emotional schemas, there's a few different things that could be happening there. One of them, one thing you could think about is maybe you use tension to distract yourself from certain emotions, right? And so you create this link between feeling an emotion and using tension to distract yourself.
Yeah, the armor.
And then, right, and then when that link is broken by either you massage out the tension or you're no longer feeling that emotion, you sort of drop that tension. So that's just like one, if people are wondering, like, this sounds so crazy, there's no way this could be real, that's one, like, model that could be happening. There's a lot of others. Once you do this experientially, you have to start looking for, like, okay, there's clearly something here. What's going on?
Yeah.
But I do think that that is a real thing. I do a lot of work myself I've done a little bit of TRE, not too much, but I do a lot of I've done a lot of electrical muscle stimulation on different parts where I'm feeling issues, and I also do sort of what people call myofascial release, you know, rolling things out and like lacrosse balls and stuff while I'm doing emotional processing. In terms of my coaching practice, a lot of it is over the phone or on video. I don't know a lot of body work. I don't know how. But I think that stuff can be very real. I think there's a lot of BS in that field as well, but I think a lot of that stuff is real, and I am pro that method of change work, although I am not the best at creating that in others.
On the crying side, how would you view crying as a therapeutic modality?
Okay, so I said that I don't think that, at the beginning, that I don't think that reconsolidation is the only thing happening. That's creating these emotional processing, big emotional changes. I think there's at least 3 things going on. One of them is what we would call processing unprocessed emotions, which is, I think, what is happening with crying. Now, I want to be very clear. I think this is really important that I don't think we call this abreaction, right? When you have this sudden emotional release. And I don't think abreaction is like always the right thing to do. I don't think it's something you should be aiming for or looking for. I think it's basically useful for people who are suppressing an emotion, and that's when abreaction can be really useful. Now, crying in particular, it seems like there's a process of grieving that's really important. It's something unfinished. There's something undone if you have not grieved for something that you were sad about.
Yes.
Now, grieving does not have to involve crying, but it often does, and it often can. And so one of the cool things about the framework that I go through is it starts out with just experiencing the emotion, allowing yourself to experience it, right? And then you challenge it more and more as you go on. And sometimes, right, the experiencing can get you that grieving, can get you that feeling, can get you that acceptance of the emotion, the feeling the emotion, and then you don't need to go through the rest of the process. You're like, oh, something happened. I'm not feeling this internal conflict. I'm not feeling this problem. I'm done right there.
No, that's cool. And I just want to know what, because having thought for most of my life that crying is useless and just silly, and now from I would say it's the number one thing that has actually changed my life for the better. I feel like I've lost, I don't know, 100 pounds emotional weight. And it's not like phenomenologically, it's like I've had a true, like, I don't know, that sounds silly to say, but like a true cry. It feels like you're saying, you're really, truly grieving something. It feels so natural. It feels so right. And afterwards, something has permanently changed. Something is lost that needed to be, it's like popping an emotional sit. It's the best way I can explain it. And you feel so goddamn good after. And you're actually, now I'm more comfortable in social interactions after. Or I can notice like something tangible in my life. So I really want to know what that means to have unresolved grief or unresolved emotion. We don't really have any good theories for that. But yeah, I definitely think there's something to that. But yeah, so something that I also think is very interesting is the concept of the shadow. I believe that this was created by Carl Jung, Freud's disciple. And yeah, the way he uses it is to describe the dark or the bad or the terrible parts of ourselves. And he talked about how, and I'm not very, very read up on Jung, but about how to become whole as a person, you kind of have to face your shadow. You have to integrate your shadow to become a full person, not just a, oh, I'm all smiles and giggles and I never think anything dark or you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm curious how you view that in general. And some people say, I know some people in my community, I don't know if you know, At Reason Is Fun, Lily Tennant.
Yeah, yeah, I know Lily pretty well.
Yeah, okay, and she retweeted your stuff. That's how I found you to begin with. But I'm not sure what her position is on shadow work, but I know she has this line of suffering is always bad, which is something I wanted to run by you as well. But let's start with, and that can tie into the shadow and working on your shadow, facing some fears, going through some phenomenologically tough stuff, and coming out the other end stronger. So yeah, how do you view the shadow and what is shadow work?
Yeah, so I think there's different ways to look at this. And I think I'm going to give a very specific definition of shadow work, and there might be people who consider themselves shadow workers who disagree with this. Because it's a very broad topic. Like you said, it's been around since Jung. It's gone in a lot of different directions. So the way I tend to think about shadow work is in juxtaposition to other types of parts work. So one way, let's say that I have rage, right? Or I have judgment, or I have hate, or I have jealousy. One way that you could work on that through a lot of types of parts work, like something like IFS, is you can try and find the quote-unquote positive intention underneath my rage, right? You could go and talk to my rage, and the rage could say, you know, there's a boundary here that's trampled. And then you could look at, and you could look at that and be like, okay, why do I want to hold that boundary? Well, because I want to protect you. Okay, why do you want to protect me? Because I want you to be happy. Why do you want to be happy? So that you can, you know, experience deep eternal bliss with everyone forever, whatever it is, right? And then I can try and quote unquote heal that rage through allowing myself to feel that eternal bliss, or through recognizing that it's not skillful. There's other ways to hold that boundary where I don't need to feel that rage, that sort of thing, right? And so that is one way to work with the shadow, but that is not what I would call shadow work. Shadow work is something more like considering that the full range of my emotional expression includes rage. Rage can feel good. Rage can feel amazing.
Yeah.
When Lily says, you know, suffering is always bad, but rage, hate, judgment are not always suffering.
No, of course not.
They can feel good. And so shadow work might look something more like, can I go into boxing class every week and express my rage in an environment that is safe for society, right? Can I view this as something that it's important for me to feel, rather than trying to quote unquote heal it? View this as part of who I am as a human, and find ways to express that all of me endorses. And I think both of these are important. In my coaching practice, I view both of these. I want to have to both heal people so that they don't feel that the rage is taking over them in places when it's not skillful or wise to do so. And I want them to have skillful, wise, powerful areas to view their rage and to not view their rage or their hate or their judgment or their jealousy as the enemy, but as a friend.
No, that's a great point. But so would you subscribe to the idea that, which I think Jung subscribed to, that, yeah, rage and dark, I mean, I'm saying dark and twisted. I mean, we can discuss whether that's accurate or not, but people understand what I mean. The twisted sexual fantasies or violent fantasies, or that they are just part of the human psyche. We all have those thoughts and emotions, or that it's always a result of, yeah, some kind of hurt or unprocessed, yeah, rage and things like that, that always have a positive intention or.
Yeah, I don't really know. I've definitely seen people heal certain traumas, and then their sexual proclivities change. And that's often in a more vanilla direction.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I've worked with people who, you know, we looked into that stuff, and it didn't seem like there was any. Like, we healed everything underneath it, and they were still just into that stuff.
Yeah.
Right? And even if it is, like, trauma or something, I think if we look at things like kink, that's sort of similar to going to the gym and wailing on the punching bag, right? Right? That's, like, it's a place where two people have consented to allow their shadows to shine and play in a way that is not suffering, but is enjoyable to both of them. And so, even if it's because of trauma, I don't think that means it's bad. I think that's it's a powerful way to begin to allow yourself to get in touch with that trauma, and it can be eventually healed, right? But getting comfortable with it, being able to play with it can be a step on that journey to allowing yourself to activate it and reconsolidate it.
Yeah. Okay, so we're coming up on the 2-hour mark here, so I'm not going to hold you here for too much longer. But I thought that maybe we could end on some Twitter questions, just sure, to engage the audience a bit. And so one of the questions was, what is happening during procrastination? I feel like we have touched on that quite thoroughly already.
Mm-hmm.
But do you want to give a very short paragraph summary of that, maybe?
Yeah, so procrastination is coming from is almost always not always but almost always coming from coercive motivation systems that create these oscillating motivation. We talked about why that was earlier. I'm not going to go back into that. And you can heal that by creating non-coercive motivation systems based around self-love and creative tension.
Wonderful. So my wife asked me, she's working from home now, and she's a very social person, much more so than me even, and he, oh wow, that was a Freudian slip right there. Yeah, so she's having issues with, her job involves juggling a lot of things at once. She says she always has like 11 different important projects that she has to do at once, and she said, how do you prioritize? How do you avoid decision overwhelm when you have tons of different things that need to be done at once and there's not a clear delineation between what's most important at any one time?
Mm-hmm. The first thing to realize when you're feeling indecisive between different tasks is that if you know the tasks well and you're still feeling indecisive between them, that means that they're really close in value, right?
Mm.
Why else would you be feeling indecisive? If you knew one was better, then you would just do that one. But that means that they're really close in value. And once you realize that they're really close in value, that means that it doesn't really matter which one you choose because they're all close in value. So the tool I like to use here is called the 30-second decision. I've gone through it. This is assuming, again, that there's not like huge uncertainty around the tasks that I want to look at to make a decision. Assuming I know all the tasks and I'm having trouble deciding, I'm just going to choose the very first option that hits my intuition, right?
Mm.
And if nothing hits my intuition, then within 30 seconds, I'm going to choose a random option. Because why am I wasting time when everything is equal in value? So that's just like a little trick there around indecision.
That's really great. Okay, and so how this might be a big question. I don't know if there's an easy answer to that, but yeah, she also asked Corona. Yeah, how? Because going to a workplace, if you're not self-employed, working from home usually, and you enjoy, you know, the social contact, and you're actually just like going to the gym. For some people, it's just easier to get things done when you're in that environment and have those incentives more clearly in front of you. How do you stay productive in your work despite being stuck at home? If there's anything general there, in the same vein.
Yeah. So first thing is making sure you're getting all your needs met. So if you have that need for being social, while you're at home, you need to make sure you're getting that need met. So I try to set things up throughout the week where I'm talking to people on Zoom, I'm connecting with different people, and making sure that I get that need met somehow. That's like one of the big causes of being unproductive at home is that there are needs that you were getting met through work that are no longer being met, and you need to make sure you're getting all your needs met. Now, we already talked about, right, just basic how to motivate yourself non-coercively.
Yeah.
That stuff is going to help a lot. And then the final thing I will talk about is desire partners. So when we're talking about this idea of accountability, right, I feel more accountable when I'm around other people and they see what I'm doing. That's coming from a very coercive frame.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah.
It's coming from a frame of I need to account to someone else for my actions. And I'll feel bad if I don't do that. So therefore, this person is making me do my stuff. But there's another way I can view this, which is desire partners, which is other people can help me refocus on the things that are most important to me, can help me remember the things that I care about, and can help me notice, right, if I'm not doing something, like, okay, what's the thing that I care about that's underneath that? What's the thing under there? So I call this the desire partner paradigm. And if you're working at home and you work better with others, I recommend you get some desire partners. You get some people who you can co-work with, who you're not trying to account for your actions to, but who are you're helping focus on the things they care about, and they're helping you focus on the things you care about.
Yeah, just like a friendly reminder. Of,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. And there's a great tool called FocusMate. If you don't have anybody like this, you can go on. And it will sort of just pair you up with a random co-working partner that I recommend checking out if that's you. And just put in your profile, hey, I'm not looking for accountability. I'm looking for a desire partner.
Yeah. Dude, you're full of good answers, huh? You've thought about this. I like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have just a few left here. So let's see. Oh, okay. This is interesting. Yeah. What is the role of medium to long-term planning in non-coercive motivation, and how specific should medium to long-term plans be?
Yeah. Yeah. So the way I do this is I have what's called a vision. And this is still, I want to acknowledge that this is still an area of growth for me that I want to think more about. But I have a long-term vision. So I go about every year or so, I try to re-elicit what are my deep values here, see if they've changed. And then I turn that value into a vision. Now, that vision could be a specific vision of like, okay, here's how all my values would show up in terms of my kids and my job and everything. But more often, that's often a metaphorical vision that brings in all these different values. So right now, my vision is sort of, I imagine there's a leaf on the wind and I'm moving that leaf. And I'm building a garden with people, and we're sending the leaves where they need to go.
Mm-hmm.
But that gets all my values. And I know in the long term, I want to be moving towards a place that feels like that, right? Mm. I don't know exactly what that place will look like, but I know if I feel more like that,
I'm going in the right direction
than I did yesterday. Yeah. I'm moving in the right direction, right?
So it's a compass more than a set destination, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. And then I'm looking at, okay, where am I at? What do I have? Right. Like, what are my current, you know, resources and skills and abilities? And like, what is therefore the biggest, you know, medium term, you know, 1 year goal that can get me closer to that? And then when I'm there, I look at the compass again and do the same thing. So that's sort of how I think about it right now. And I think I do have more thinking on this and like how to think about this. That I don't think this is sort of the final thing. I think there's people better than me who can talk about long-term plans.
Right. Okay, cool. I think it was the same person who asked this, but yeah, what about overthinking too much detail? How does that factor into non-coercion? And also, I love this question, how do you know when to stop trying?
Yeah. So, overthinking. I think that factors in quite a bit to non-coercion simply because we find that people who overthink are often suppressing their feelings. So the way I like to think about decisions is what's called the whole body yes. This is not my framework.
So the hell yes.
But I use it a lot.
Slivers or...
Yeah, similar to the hell yes or no. The whole body yes is I'm checking in with my mind, my thoughts, my heart, my emotions, and then my gut and my intuitions. And if all of those are a yes, then that's a yes for me. So overthinking people will often overweight the mind over the other things. And then people can go the other direction. They discover their intuitions and they're like, all right, I'm just going to let my intuitions guide me and not use my thinking at all. But I think the most skillful way to do it is look for a yes from all three of mind, heart, and gut.
Right. And that we can tie that back to, but we don't have infinite time. As an objection to that, that might not always be a plausible way to make a decision, right? But I guess you can choose the one that's the most close to that. Right.
So the way I actually think about this, I don't think about a yes from all three. But I really think about is I want a yes from one of them and not a no from the other two at the very least, right?
I know that sounds more
It doesn't have to be like, oh, this is the most passionate, amazing, powerful thing you can do.
All body
just like,
orgasm every time.
Exactly. Exactly.
But that's on the vision board.
I want a yes from one and not a no from the other two.
Yeah, no, that's a better heuristic. Yeah. Okay, so the absolute last one is my own. And it's during this conversation I've thought about, we touched upon the internal versus external motivation kind of thing. And I think that oftentimes the outside-in approach of, ignore the emotional and just try to build all these habits and tactics from the outside, that doesn't really work. And what I've taken from your perspective here is that you're saying also that the inside-out perspective doesn't work that well always by itself either. And so my question is how, like I'm thinking of Tim Ferriss, for instance. And he has all these rules. And for instance, one is do the most important task the first thing you wake up. Little tweaks like that. I've kind of become somewhat allergic to those now when I've noticed the efficiency of inside out. But would you still tell me not to throw those tips away? Are they still useful to combine with that? Or, how do you view that?
So when I'm building the procrastination playbook, I like to use this framework called it's called the experiential array, which is when you look at how people internalize new ways of being, it starts with your beliefs and your motivations. And then on top of that, you build your skills and intuitions, your strategies and emotions. Sorry, your strategies and emotions, right? So you start with your beliefs and motivations, then your strategies and emotions. And then on top of that, you build your behaviors and environment.
Mm-hmm.
But you need all of those to really internalize the new way of being, to really make it the most skillful it can be. So I would say if you had to choose between the outside in and the inside out, start with the inside out because the motivations, the strategies, and the emotions are underlying everything.
Yeah.
But you're not going to fully be able to internalize things, use them skillfully without the outside in. So I would not become, I think it's a common, the thing you're falling into is a common thing where people just say, oh my God, it's so easy just to, you know, process my emotions and I do everything perfectly. And they miss out on some of these habits, right? I would say start with the inside out, but make sure you eventually do get to the outside.
All right. Perfect words to end on. And Matt, you have thoroughly persuaded me that I need to have you as my coach. So this was a great conversation. I had a lot of fun and I learned a lot. So thanks a lot for coming on, man. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much. And yeah, have a great day, Chris.
You too. Bye.